Now's the time to find your color, your paint, and everything to get started during Red, White, and Blue Savings at the Home Depot. Transforming your room is easier than ever. With the best deals online and in-store, you can confidently select your color and the tools for your next paint project. Get a colorful new experience and the right paint for the right price. Save $10 on 1 gallon and $40 off 3 and 5 gallons for a limited time only at the Home Depot. More saving, more doing. Limit 25 gallons per household. See store for details.
This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Good evening. You're tuned in to 2 Degrees Centigrade. I'm your host, Ezra Zaid. This is a show where we talk about how climate change is affecting us today and why our everyday choices matter and what we can do to mitigate those consequences. Today's show is about what nations around the world are doing to address climate change. And in particular, we're going to look at the Paris Agreement, which was negotiated at the Paris Climate Change Conference in 2015. The Paris Agreement laid down a commitment to limit global warming to 2 degrees Celsius above pre-industrial levels. But how attainable is the 2 degrees limit, and what exactly goes into consideration in global environmental negotiations? To help us understand the complicated nature of the issue of climate change, I'll be speaking with Hilary Chu. She's a climate change researcher at the locally based NGO Third World Network. Maybe we just begin with a little story about yourself, I guess, about how you first got interested in this issue. Was it something that you noticed as an adult? Was it as a teenager? Did you sort of have an attachment to the environment? What were the first few memories that came to mind about being concerned about the environment?
Well, I was an environmental journalist with a newspaper in Malaysia for quite some time, and for 17 and a half years, actually. And for the last 7 years or so, I was covering environment issues. From that, I got interested with climate change issues.
And what did you uncover, I guess, in your reporting about the environment? What were the obvious things that were happening in Malaysia, at least, about what was done and what wasn't done?
Okay. I noticed how the policy shapes things that we do and we don't do, or what we do very badly. And I got really interested in the policy angle when I covered the environmental stories. Wildlife trade is one of the big thing. And then I got very interested with forestry issue, the politics behind forestry. And from forestry, actually, that's my sort of like a jumping pad, you know, into climate change. Because I see the issue of deforestation, very bad logging practices, and the impact of it on indigenous people. And I got really interested in issues like REDD+.
So for those of you who might not be familiar with REDD+, it is a climate change mitigation strategy that was created by the United Nations Framework Convention on Climate Change. REDD+ stands for Reducing Emissions from Deforestation and Forest Degradation. And it's an effort to offer financial incentives for developing countries to reduce emissions from forested lands and to invest in low carbon methods to sustainable development.
So that actually was the door, the opening door to climate change issue for me.
And at the time, as your interest grew, did you notice that there was not enough coverage on this issue either by policymakers or the media? I mean, what year was that?
Definitely.
What year was that?
I think that would be about 2007. Yeah, around that time. Then I think 2007 was the COP in Bali. And then I applied for a scholarship and I got it, and I attended my first climate COP, which was 2008 in Poznan in Poland. And then after that was 2009 in Copenhagen, and I also covered that COP. Yeah, that's how I started to cover that COP. And then I got acquainted to Third World Network, which is a Malaysian NGO. Naturally, I know them back home. And then they were playing a very big role in this climate negotiation. So then I started to got interested in their work, and that's how I joined them in 2010.
It's really interesting that you mentioned about 2007, because I think even in my experience, over the past 10 to 12 to 13 years, the issue of climate change has been knocking on the door of just the general citizen. It used to be people involved within these issues, but now it just got to a point where everybody's talking about it and everybody's taking notice of it. I think I remember watching An Inconvenient Truth by Al Gore, and it was a documentary that, at least in layman's terms, explained how much change is taking place with regards to our climate and the effects of it on mankind. Yeah. Have a listen to this clip taken from the documentary film An Inconvenient Truth, directed by Davis Guggenheim, and it featured former U.S. Vice President Al Gore.
The assumption is something like this. The Earth is so big, we can't possibly have any lasting harmful impact on the Earth's environment. And maybe that was true at one time, but it's not anymore. And one of the reasons it's not true anymore is that the most vulnerable part of the Earth's ecological system is the atmosphere. Vulnerable because it's so thin. My friend, the late Carl Sagan, used to say, if you had a big globe with a coat of varnish on it, the thickness of that varnish relative to that globe is pretty much the same as the thickness of the Earth's atmosphere compared to the Earth itself. And it's thin enough that we are capable of changing its composition. That brings up the basic science of global warming.
Do you feel that frustration about how people don't really quite care enough about this issue?
I don't really feel that strongly that people don't care, because from my experience as an environmental journalist, I know that it is policy that will set the direction of travel. And it is not really, you know, quote unquote, the fault of the people. So it is decision makers, policy makers, you know, our politicians, if you like, you know, that has to shape the direction that we travel, that have to decide what kind of policy we will undertake or not, you know. And of course, it has to be in the interest of the public. So I'm not frustrated, you know, like with the public for not doing enough, more like because they don't know what they should do or should not do.
And when it comes to the issue of climate change, what was the biggest concern that dawned upon you as you realized the severity of our current situation?
Is that the window is really closing. We are not able to stabilize the climate, you know. And what is very frustrating for us who followed the negotiation is that we know, the leaders know what they should do, but they are dragging their feet for whatever reason. I mean, of course, we know what we can guess at some of the reason, because climate change is not just an environmental issue. It is also an economic issue. So a lot of these countries, as I'm talking about the developed countries, they are dragging their feet or they do not want to act, even though they are in the position to act, because they feel that if they were to act in a certain manner and cut their emission very rapidly, then it will have an economic impact on their development. Yeah, and they are in a very comfortable position and they do not want to give up that leading position in the economic to the other developing country that are catching up. So then they start to point the fingers at the Chinas, at the Indias, you know, at Malaysias, you know, all these countries that are developing, and they say that you have to take on responsibility as well. But sadly, also, people in this developing country also bought into that narrative. But I guess that is also because the narrative is so prevalent in the media, right? And our news consumption, especially on climate change news, we rely on a lot of foreign inputs. So you don't read much about the news articles written by Malaysian journalists, right? And our shape and our views about climate change is very much shaped by the Western media.
So talk to me a little bit more about that narrative that you're referring to. What exactly is that?
That narrative is that this is a global problem. Everybody has a responsibility, right? And look at China and India. They are the biggest emitter and they are the fastest growing emitters, right? And so they have to take on the responsibility. But this sort of narrative is not put in the proper context. The context is that these are developing countries, right? And they have huge population. And if you look at the per capita emission, Chinese and an Indian, their emission per capita is so much lower than the developed countries.
Right.
The citizen of developed countries, you know. Like, for example, an American, their per capita emission is 20 ton. No, a Chinese, at that time in like 2008, 2010, they are about 4 tons. And an Indian is so, so small, you know. You know, in all the states in India, even though India is a developing country, actually you look at all the individual states in India, they are actually a least developed countries. That's their status. So their emission is very, very low. But then the narrative is shaped in such a way that everybody is putting their attention on China and on India and not realizing that, you know, even in the convention, the UN Framework Convention on Climate Change, the principle is very clear. And it's very clearly stated in the convention who are actually the quote-unquote culprits of climate change. It is the developed country because of their industrialization in the past. And of course, now it's developing country because we follow the same model of development.
And the developed countries, or I guess the culprits, quote-unquote, they would be who exactly?
Well, the biggest emitter used to be US. Of course, China has caught up in 2008, right? But that is also because China is basically the workshop and the factory of the whole world.
Yes. You know,
everything is made in China, right, at one point in time, right? And still is to a certain extent. And these are actually emissions that has been outsourced to another country. When they develop country, shift their production into developing country because developing country has very poor environmental laws, right? And then it's cheap, the land is cheap, water is cheap, electricity is cheap, and labor is cheap. So developing country became the producer for everyone, including the developed countries.
Now, just before that, you mentioned a very interesting phrase, and it's a phrase that in every article or in every video that I see on Facebook about global warming and climate change is that the window is closing.
Mm.
Could you explain that to the person on the street about what that means exactly and what the consequences are about that window?
Yeah. You try to imagine this atmospheric space, right? And the science, the IPCC, the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, says that there is only this amount that you could pump into the atmosphere. And after this, you're going to have catastrophic climate change impact, right? And that space is growing smaller and smaller because we keep pumping, putting in more carbon dioxide and all the other greenhouse gases into this atmosphere. So the latest is that with this Paris Agreement, we look at all the climate change action the country said they would do. Okay, the climate change action, the focus that we always look at is the mitigation, which is the emission cut. But there are also other aspects like adaptation, for instance, right? And also finance and technology. But this climate change action shows that they did an aggregate. They look at all the climate change action the country has submitted before 1st October of 2015, before the Paris Agreement. And it shows that we are going to miss this 2 degrees Celsius. We are not able to keep temperature rise to 2 degrees Celsius.
It's
2 degrees Celsius means 40 gigatons per year, you know, that we could pump in. We have to bring that down to that. At the moment now, we have already surpassed 50 gigatons per year.
So is it too late now, all of these attempts at trying to mitigate it?
Well, I don't want to sound so negative, but when we say the window is narrowing, you know, some people even think, because in Paris Agreement, we say we should try to pursue 1.5 degrees Celsius, even 1.5, not just 2 degrees, right? But I personally think we have already missed the window for 1.5, but we could still try. We have to try very, very hard to bring down the emission between now to 2020. And actually, the developed country, if they were to pick their emission very quickly now, we could still do it.
That's Hilary Chu, climate change researcher at Third World Network. After this, we'll consider what happens to people as climate change worsens around the world. Stay tuned. This is 2 degrees centigrade on the Evening Edition, BFM 89.9.
Now's the time to find your color, your paint, and everything to get started during red, white, and blue savings at the Home Depot. Transforming your room is easier than ever. With the best deals online and in-store, you can confidently select your color and the tools for your next paint project. Get a colorful new experience and the right paint for the right price. Save $10 on 1 gallon and $40 off 3 and 5 gallons for a limited time only at the Home Depot. More saving, more doing. Limit 25 gallons per household. See store for details.
Be firmly motivated. BFM 89.9.
Welcome back to 2 Degrees Centigrade with me, Ezra Zayed. Today we're talking about the Paris Agreement and what the world is doing in the task of controlling the progress of climate change. My guest is Hilary Chu from Third World Network. And the consequences of hitting those 2 degrees, could you describe some?
Well, we already have, you know, started to experience extreme weather events, right? Prolonged drought and very, very frequent drought. You know, the drought are getting longer and they are more frequent. So like, for example, the continent of Africa, because it's a huge land mass. So now you are seeing sub-Saharan Africa and even the northern Africa is facing this huge challenge of drought and famine. And then, of course, there's also sea level rise. Of course, we don't feel the impact now because that is a slow onset events. Yeah, that's described as a slow onset events. But definitely, the permafrost is also melting.
So permafrost refers to a layer of soil or rock that is frozen all year round. And when it melts, it releases methane, which is a powerful greenhouse gas, and therefore contributes to global warming.
The other extreme event is that, like, for example, you know, yesterday there's this very tragic incident where a couple was struck by lightning.
That's right. They were jogging in the park in Puchong, and
before the rain came, they noticed that the rain is going to come, so they wanted to leave, but then they were struck by lightning.
Yeah.
So the incident of lightning is also increasing, and you could link that to climate change as well. Yeah. Because you have a stronger cyclone, you know. So these are the things that we are starting to experience. Yeah. But whether our policymakers and our agencies are on their foot now, or are they fast enough, or are they watching all these things and realize that we are really not moving fast enough. We really have to do more.
So the Paris Agreement, you know, for folks who may not be familiar, what's the most significant part about the Paris Agreement and how those countries came together to sign this accord?
Well, before Paris Agreement, there is another climate treaty. That's Kyoto Protocol. And under Kyoto Protocol, only developed country has an obligation to cut their emission. A Paris Agreement is hailed as a historical a moment and a historical agreement, you know, all those accolades. Because now, apparently, every country agreed that they have to cut emission, right? So that's historical in that sense. So they call that the global treaty, global climate agreement, where actually they completely forget about Kyoto Protocol, because for developed country, they rather not talk about Kyoto Protocol because they are saying that everybody has responsibility. But earlier on, we talked about, you know, how actually the responsibility has to be differentiated, right? But that principle is still there in Paris Agreement. So developing country fought very hard to keep that principle. And it's not easy. So now, Paris Agreement said that we will hold temperature rise to 2 degrees and pursue 1.5. So that is something that is very positive. But whether we can do it or not is something else. Because even in as country adopt this Paris Agreement, they recognize that all the climate action plan of all the countries that have submitted up to 1st October 2015 before Paris Agreement, we are not going to reach 2 degrees. We are actually fooling ourselves if we think we can halt temperature rise to 2 degrees. Yeah, but also Paris Agreement talk about loss and damage. Okay, the first time that there is actually an article in the treaty that talk about loss and damage. Loss and damage is that you cannot adapt anymore to the impact of climate change, right? You are facing loss, like for example, island states, you know, it's an existential threat. They are losing their land to the sea, you know. So what do you do with this? This is already a loss and it's a damage to this country. So they have to migrate, you know. Where are they going to put their population, you know? For example, there's one country in the Pacific Island is actually buying land in another Pacific Island to move its population. Who is going to pay for this?
The Pacific nation that Hillary is referring to is Kiribati. Here is the island nation's former president, Anote Tong, who bought 20 square kilometers on Vanua Levu, one of Fiji's islands.
The threat of the rising sea level is a real danger. And I think we have seen communities being washed out. The villages have gone. And so we've had to relocate some of these communities. It's not nice. And I think the reality is that this will become more frequent as time goes by. The sad and the most unfortunate aspect of the issue is that we really have not contributed to the cause of the problem. Yet, we are the first victims.
Bear in mind, this is a least developed country, and many of the island states are least developed country, especially in the Pacific side. You know, and who is going to pay for all this money? But even though we have an article called Loss and Damage, but there is another supplementary decision document that says that you cannot hold developed country responsible for this. There's no liability. So, but nevertheless, developing country are still trying to fight. So between now, 2017 to 2016 last year, up to 2020, this is the period where we have to discuss the modalities, procedures, and guidelines. How are we going to implement Paris Agreement?
The actual implementation.
Yes.
The devil's in the details.
Yes.
About this. And it is one thing for everybody to sign it, but it's one thing about how the respective countries are going to adapt to it as well.
Right.
How was it decided at the Paris Agreement that the limit for global warming should be at 2 degrees Celsius? Was it something that there was consensus among the scientific community, and was it just a unanimous element to it?
The scientific community, the AR5, IPCC AR5, the fifth assessment report, is also a very political document. It is for some of us observers who knows the politics of climate change, we followed the IPCC process as well. And we noticed that, very sadly, that it is also very politicized.
What, deciding the 2 degrees was a political element?
There was a political element to it? It is. Because if you were to say 1.5, that means you have to put in more money, right? You have to really make sure there's technology transfer for developing country to leapfrog. Yeah? A lot of developing countries, they are still dependent on the fossil fuel technology. They need to leapfrog to renewable energy technologies, right? And this costs money because the technologies are patented. And the patents are with the developed country. Yeah. So it is very political because, as I said, if you say 1.5, you have to put in more money. And that support has to come from developed country. So if you put it at 2...
A little bit more room to negotiate, I guess.
Yes.
And so you've caught me about how political it is. But it was still a breakthrough then, in some respects, that all
it is a breakthrough because there's a lot of compromise, yeah?
And what were some of the key compromises?
For example, in the loss and damage that I just mentioned, the least developed country and the island state in particular, you know, they are the strongest proponents of loss and damage. I mean, understandably, because they are the one at the front line, you know? So they will be affected most by all the impacts of climate change. They could adopt the agreement, not just the Paris Agreement, but the attending decision that actually says that there's no liability. You cannot claim liability. So that is a huge compromise for them, right? And another compromise is on finance. The word shall and should. At the very last moment, before the gavel was brought down, the United States actually changed the word shall to should for that particular article on mitigation. And there was one country that tried to object, but the French presidency gavel anyway. So that was very controversial, that last part of the night in Paris.
Why was that significant between shall and should?
Because shall is very, very strong word. Yeah, should is watered down. You should, but doesn't mean that you have to, you know. It's almost like you are encouraged to, you know. All these words have legal connotation to it. So if it's shall, it's very, very clear. You shall do this, yeah? So that was a huge compromise. At the very last moment, country were caught because you don't want to upset the French presidency as well because they have been playing such a wonderful job, you know, as a host and they were very hands-on in moving the negotiation. There were very difficult moments and then they've tried every means to make sure that the Paris conference will not collapse like Copenhagen. So at that very crucial moment, crunch time, you don't want to be upsetting everyone else by, you know, raising your flag and say that I cannot accept this decision. So now, after Paris, you start to interpret the decision and you notice that country has very different ways of interpreting it. So now is the time where you have to find out what is the interpretation.
I gather that particular decision must have raised a lot of alarm bells amongst other countries, you know, to raise that objection between shall and should.
Some country, yes. But as I say, it is the crunch time now, it's the last moment of the night on Saturday. You don't want to be that sole time standing there and objecting, you know. Like in Copenhagen, there were a lot of countries objecting to the Copenhagen Accord. So you are not alone, you know. Yeah, even though there were some countries that were very dramatic, they bang on the table to get attention, you know. The mic will switch off, you know. That kind of nonsense going on in this UN negotiation, you know. For people who don't know the process and don't know, no clue about what's going on, you're just like, this is incredible. This is the UN and these are all dignified people. How come they are behaving like this, jumping on the table, you know, knocking very hard and cut their hands and all that kind of thing just to get attention? Developing country I'm talking about. So this is not Copenhagen. So the French presidency has managed to steer the negotiation very carefully and very diplomatically, very shrewdly, and they got the Paris Agreement.
I'm speaking with Hilary Chu, climate change researcher at the locally based NGO Third World Network. After the news, we'll be looking at something called Nationally Determined Contributions, or NDCs, which are the climate pledges that have been made by different countries. Stay tuned to 2 Degrees Centigrade on the evening edition, BFM 89.9.
Bringing fresh meaning. BFM 89.9.
Welcome back. This is 2 Degrees Centigrade with me, Ezra Zayed. This is the show where we talk about how climate change is affecting us today and how we can cope with these changes through innovative measures for sustainability. Today, I've been speaking with Hilary Chu, who is a climate change researcher at Third World Network. We've been taking a look at the promises that have been made by different countries in the Paris Agreement and how they play different roles in the global task of halting climate change. Here's more of my conversation with Hilary. So the agreement included nationally determined contributions, or NDCs, which are goals for individual countries. And we spoke earlier about how moving forward is all about how these countries act and implement some of these elements. Could you tell us a little bit more about them and what that constitutes?
Many countries that put in their NDCs has also clearly distinguished what are the actions that they would do voluntarily and what are the actions that is conditional. So there's unconditional and conditional. So like, for instance, Malaysia says that we would do 45% emission intensity reduction from our GDP. And 35% is unconditional and 10% is conditional. So the 10% means that we could do this much to cut the emission and contribute towards this global effort. But this 10% of our action need to be supported with finance, technology, capacity building. So many countries have that kind of NDCs. So
an unconditional and a conditional element.
That's right. I'm talking about developing country, but not developed country. They should not have any condition. Okay, they have to do it, right? So because they are still annex one country, developed country, and their responsibility is different from us. So many of these. So if you look at the conditional part, so earlier you were talking about whether we could achieve this. We could really halt climate change, you know, and save ourselves from this crisis. If the conditional parts of all these NDCs of developing country are fulfilled with finance, technology and capacity building, then I think we have a very good chance to stabilize the climate at 2 degrees Celsius.
And in fulfilling both these unconditional and conditional elements, I'm trying to think about, you know, apart from the noble cause of halting climate change, mm-hmm. are there incentives in some way for these countries to encourage them to actually follow through with some of these contributions?
Yes, because if you talk about mitigation, so when you cut your emission, it's not just that you cut your emission, right? And then that will contribute towards the global effort. But there's also co-benefits. Like, for example, in the forestry sector, if you stop deforestation, right, and you practice a good logging system. And so the co-benefit is that you are actually helping to adapt as well, right? So you don't deforest, then you're actually stabilizing your local climate. And when you stabilize your local climate, you won't get all this kind of freak storm, yeah? Theoretically, you won't get that kind of thing. So you are actually minimizing your impact and you're helping yourself to adapt to these climate impacts.
And how are we tracking all of this progress?
For this convention, climate convention, there is actually a national reporting process. So every 4 years, you have to submit a national communication. So you're telling the whole world what you're doing in terms of mitigation, adaptation, what are your challenges, and what kind of research you are doing, and systematic observation, you know, all these sorts of things. And also reporting about your vulnerability and how you're adapting to it. So you are tracking. So every country will have to submit their national communication every 4 years for developing country, and also a biannual update report every 2 years. So the national reporting itself is actually quite a burden for developing country, you know, especially you have to submit your greenhouse gas inventory. So that involves a lot of capacity building, technical knowledge, and also like how do you collect your figures and then your data compilers, whether they have the skill and the technique to compile all this data and then to analyze this data. So it is a huge challenge for developing country. Even developed country, I look at some of their national communication, they themselves also find it quite challenging for some sectors. But, you know, they are developed country, they have a lot of information, they have been tracking their data. Whereas for a lot of developing countries, you are only starting to do these things. So it's a huge challenge. So, but developing countries are also being supported in terms of finance as well to do your national communication and your biannual update report.
So help me understand this. You know, it was also agreed that these NDCs would not be binding as a matter of international law. Tell me why that was the case, and is the name and shame system an effective measure of doing so?
So that is actually also a compromise. Because under Kyoto Protocol, it's a top-down. You have an aggregate, you said you would do this much, and then you distribute the burden to all the other developing countries, like EU, US, Canada, Japan, you know. But Paris Agreement is a pledge and review. It's voluntary as well. But as you said, it's the name and shame. So it's, you submit your NDC, and then you submit your national communication, and then your BOR. This is where then they will track whether you are doing enough or not, you know. So in an ideal world, it should not be that way. But because, as I said, this is not an environmental issue. It's about your economic development as well. So country has compromised on this. So when we compromise on this, and then we end up with this kind of system, pledge and review and name, sort of name and shame, right? So it is not, if you ask me, it's not the best system, but it's the best that we can get now.
How are most countries doing right now with regards to their nationally determined contributions? Are there challenges that each country is facing, perhaps Malaysia as well?
Yeah. In the case of Malaysia, earlier we said the 45% and 35% unconditional and 10% conditional. I would imagine the 10% conditional would be a lot on the mitigation side. You know, our RMK11 says that we will rely 53% of our energy on coal. So while we adopt coal technology, but what we could do in terms of mitigate is to get better technology, like your ultra-supercritical or supercritical power plant. So those technology, if you can introduce in your coal power plant, then you will actually make sure that for every unit of coal that you burn, you actually get more energy. So in that sense, you cut down on your fuel, right, your fuel sources, but you get this better amount of energy, and that will contribute towards your mitigation emission.
Now, we spoke a little bit earlier about tracking our progress, given that, you know, the Paris Accords were only quite recently. Are we relatively on track right now?
It's quite a difficult question to answer because if you remember in Copenhagen, our Prime Minister said that we will cut emission by 40% emission intensity of GDP. And then now we have our NDC, INDC, and then it's converted to NDC after we have a rectified Paris Agreement. We said 45%. So it is 45% from 2005 to 2020. That was for the Copenhagen Pledge. And then the Paris Agreement, NDC now, it is 2021 to 2030. So it is still not clear that this 45% include the 40% that we have said we would do before 2020. But it looks to me, it's like we are actually transferring what we said we will do before 2020 to post-2020. So in that sense, we are not very ambitious.
Right. It sounds like we've also overcommitted ourselves.
In Copenhagen, yeah. Perhaps. Yeah. But yeah, that is unconditional. And then we have report coming out, a statement coming out from the ministry saying that we have already achieved up to 35% in 2015. Of our 40%. So this is a question that the ministry have to answer.
You're skeptical about those figures.
Yeah, I have a feeling that the 45% include the 40% that they would say they would do. So if the statement is accurate from the ministry that they have already achieved 35% of the 40% in 2015, that means basically the unconditional part, we don't have to do anything anymore. We have already achieved it. So we are now just waiting for money post-2020 to do that 10%. So, in actual fact, that is not very ambitious. So, if it's conditional, maybe we could have said conditional 20%, we would do more. Yeah. But then again, the question is whether Malaysia, I'm also thinking the ministry perhaps have this in mind when they decide on those figures that they have a capacity problem. That's what I suspect. That they realize that they don't have the ability to do it. Because of various reasons, not so much about whether we can get the technology or the finance, is that institutionally we are not ready. And so that is a worrying thing for me, that we, as a country, our institutional support is not there to help us to achieve all these targets.
Could you give me an example of the lack of institutional support that is required to achieve some of these objectives?
For instance, I think as a country, our ministry are not paying attention enough to this issue of climate change. We have signed on to a lot of agreement. all kinds of environmental agreement, but we are actually finding ourselves in a situation where our civil servants, they don't have the ability to even perhaps, you know, interpret those decisions, what we need to do, right? Like in terms of national reporting, it is a very onerous task, but a lot of agencies are only starting to learn about climate change and starting to familiarize themselves with how to report this, their activities and what kind of activities actually will contribute to climate mitigation and what kind of adaptation we need to do, right? We are really quite behind. In some instances, I think for the past few years, we have neglected this area for so much that we are actually behind some African countries, sad to say. And in terms of negotiation, we don't even have a dedicated delegation to go and negotiate. So post-Paris is a very important period where you are going to decide on the modalities, the procedures and the guidance. Basically, this is a technical work that we need to do, but we don't have that kind of technical capacity. We don't have a dedicated delegation. And that is a very worrying thing.
I'm speaking with Hilary Chu, climate change researcher at Third World Network. After this, we'll continue our conversation about Malaysia's progress and the implications of the Kelantan government's decision to strike a carbon offset deal. Stay tuned to 2 degrees centigrade on the evening edition, BFM 89.9.
Bombing frustrated minds, BFM 89.9.
Good evening. You're back on 2 degrees centigrade. I'm Ezra Zayed. And on the show today, I've been speaking with Hilary Chu from Third World Network. Here's the rest of our conversation about Malaysia's progress and specifically on the state of Kelantan and their move to sign a deal with a carbon credit company, Climate Protectors. Are you concerned about the lack of consistency, at least in approaching this issue of climate change? Because there can be a lot of signatures on a paper, but if there's no investment in capacity building and technology, then any of these agreements that we sign are deemed worthless.
Well, you see, as a developing country, we can get finance, right? So you were talking about whether we are really committed or not and we are doing things. For example, we could get money from the Green Climate Fund. Up to today, Malaysia has not put in a single proposal to get money. And that actually suggests that there is a breakdown in the system, in the governance, in the implementation, the focal point, which is the natural resource and environment. They are not getting their acts together. Many countries have already submitted the proposal. We have not done so yet. I know that we are going to submit proposal for REP Plus, but because of the Kelantan Forest Carbon Deal, so even this effort is being jeopardized. And I don't see the ministry taking very proactive measure to resolve this problem. The minister has said something, has come out with a statement almost a month after the Kelantan Forest deal was signed to say that the state should not go ahead with this. But now, what are you going to do with the agreement that Kelantan has signed with this private company?
Let's talk a little bit about that. A couple of months ago, Kelantan signed a deal with local carbon credit company Climate Protectors in a bid to reduce emissions from deforestation and forest degradation. Could you explain to us how carbon credit works?
So carbon credit means you purchase a certificate that gives you that credit to offset your emission, your obligation to cut emission reduction. So in the carbon trading and carbon in this carbon offset scheme, basically, you are offsetting what you can't do, right? So there is the voluntary market and the mandatory market. So mandatory market is under Kyoto Protocol. So currently, under Paris Agreement, there is no carbon market yet. So this Kelantan deal, for me, has a lot of questions. When I read the news, when I go to the website, a lot of red flags comes up. So I imagine the ministry, if they are paying attention to this issue, that kind of same red flag will also appear for them. So it is very important that they really quickly resolve this issue with Kelantan.
Well, maybe let's take a look at the perspective of the state of Kelantan, for example. Why do we think then did they sign onto this arrangement and what were the benefits on their part?
Well, I think Kelantan thinks that they are going to get money from this deal, obviously, right? Lock up their forests, no more logging, and then we can get money from this carbon market. So what is also very perplexing is that Kelantan as like many other states in Malaysia, as all the states in Malaysia, they have also bought into this National Red Plus Strategy Plan. And Malaysia has submitted a reference level. Basically, it's a document to say that we have this much of carbon in all our forest reserve, and we are entitled to compensation, and international funding should come to us, you know. So they are making this plan already. So Kelantan is fully aware of this. So it is quite strange to me why Kelantan chose to go and sign this agreement. And on top of that, not informing the national government, the federal government. So obviously the federal government is in the dark until the news came out on January 9, they signed the agreement with this private company, right? And it's for 30 years. I'm not sure whether Kelantan, the policy maker and the decision maker, aware what they have actually signed themselves away for.
And how do you foresee it to be detrimental in the long term?
So now, for the reference level that Malaysia has submitted, it has actually thrown a spanner into that whole project. So I think they will have to review the reference level. And mind you, they have gone through a tremendous process, a lot of process, technical review and all that. It's a very long, tedious process. So they will have to redo that reference level again without Kelantan. If Kelantan indeed said that they are going to go ahead. So the whole plan is disrupted by the Kelantan Forest Carbon Deal.
And our concern is that, of course, other states
may
emulate this particular move for their own respective state interests.
Yeah, yeah. In fact, the company was very bold. On February 1st, they issued another statement and telling other states to emulate Kelantan. And yeah, I think other states will probably not knowing better if they don't have civil servant that understand what is this reference level and give them the proper advice, they are going to follow Kelantan.
And last few questions, Hillary. I mean, I'm trying to make sense about, I guess, the roles of different stakeholders, whether you're talking about legislators, civil society, media and the public. I mean, what can be done, do you think, to push for better policies and better awareness to deal with this massive issue like climate change?
Yeah, the Malaysian civil society, when it comes to climate change, is the environmental NGO that are paying attention to it. And even some of the environment NGO, because they are very national kind of NGO, they are not so clued in about the politics. So usually you hear things like, you know, generally they will say that Malaysia is not doing enough, very critical of Malaysian climate action. But then again, we're back to the very, very first thing that we talk about, the context, right? They don't understand the common but differentiated responsibility. So oftentimes their statement is without that kind of context. So it's like, we are really not doing enough, you know, we are so bad, you know. But seriously, if you look at what we are doing, we have our challenges, right? And we are doing what we should be doing as a developing country. But of course, as I said earlier, we are not doing enough. Like in terms of our institutional arrangement, we are not active in getting money from a Green Climate Fund. And we are not even we are dragging our feet in terms of our technology need assessment that we are supposed to submit to the UN as well. But civil society, besides the environmental group, the other group could also look into the climate issue. For example, it is also a human rights issue, right? And it's also about rights to development, you know, when you bring in the principle of CBDR. You know? So civil society could do well to raise the awareness level if they themselves could spend a little bit more time to understand the politics of climate change. I mean, basically, that would be my own personal demand for civil society. To find out more. And then for the media, because it's a very, very complex issue. And I feel that our media are really not on top of things, right? And again, they rely so much on foreign media. And this foreign Western media narrative, which actually reflects the narrative of their policymaker, is often the one that shape our public opinion about climate change.
Tell me, Hillary, I mean, if you could shape the narrative that would serve Malaysia's interests or interests of developing countries, what would it look like? Because I think it's a really complex issue, and a lot of the think tanks and, you know, the great sort of explainers on this issue, they do come from the West and they do sort of do so with their interests in mind. But let's say, you know, developing countries got together and we were to shape a narrative that is equally as compelling, but of course it actually reflects our interests. Would it look that different?
Yes, it will look very different. For instance, in negotiation, we have the group called the Like-Minded Developing Countries, where Malaysia is a member. That group was instrumental in shaping how Paris Agreement. Of course, it was a compromise, as with any other international negotiation. But we maintained the CBDR principle. For the longest time, since Bali COP, the developed country, NX1, has tried to dilute this principle. And developing country gradually came together, and they have this group called the LMDC, which is made up of 20 over countries. And they have fought back the effort to dilute this principle. So defending that principle was a key success, if you like, for Paris Agreement. And we have an Article 3 there that was fought very hard. It was put in there successfully by LMDC. So people who follow the negotiation and report on the negotiation, you hear that kind of narrative coming up from developing country very strongly. But these things are not carried by our media in developing country, right? It's also because media in developing country don't pay that much of attention to so-called environmental news, even though, as we said time and again, climate change is not just about environment. And we don't have the capacity among our journalists to follow this kind of negotiation because it's very technical, right? And I think one thing journalists are disheartened to follow because they don't have the support from their editors many times. And if you want to send a journalist to the conference, to the climate COP, very often I think the news desk would not even think about it. Why should we send? We will just listen to BBC, we will just use Reuters and AP, you know. That will save us money, you know. But they don't realize the economic dimension to the climate negotiation. They have not caught up at all. That is the case. There are only really, really a small one or two journalists that I've seen from developing country that follow the negotiation and understand the politics. That also from their own personal hard work and with support from one or two editors back home.
Hillary, what are some of the trends that you've observed in the past few years that gives you some optimism that there's progress happening in our neck of the woods in combating climate change?
For one is, I think you see China, the biggest emitter now, really wants to play a big role. So if China is able to really move on to renewable energy in a big way, that would really be a positive step forward. And developing country, you have Paris Agreement now. You can't say you're not going to do anything. By hook or by crook, you have to do it. Yeah, and you will stand to be in name and shame, even though it is, you know, it is not legally binding or whatever, but the pressure will come in other ways. And if we as civil society are able to also monitor back home how our government is performing and put pressure on government, also at the same time, putting pressure on the international community for finance and technology, then I think we'll make some positive impacts in this area.
That was Hillary Chu. She's a climate change researcher at Third World Network. This episode of 2 Degrees Centigrade was produced by Josie Liu. If you missed any part of this program, download the podcast on our app that's available on Google Play and the Apple App Store. I'm Ezra Zayed on the Evening Edition, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.
Now's the time to find your color, your paint, and everything to get started during red, white, and blue savings at the Home Depot. Transforming your room is easier than ever. With the best deals online and in-store, you can confidently select your color and the tools for your next paint project. Get a colorful new experience and the right paint for the right price. Save $10 on 1 gallon and $40 off 3 and 5 gallons for a limited time only at the Home Depot. More saving, more doing. Limit 25 gallons per household. See store for details.